Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. Podcast One presents Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews, the ultimate insider's scoop on the best new books. Every week, Kirkus brings you author interviews, recommendations from the bestseller list, and insights into books that are not yet on your radar.
I feel like my writing is useful to people, and that's the most important thing. If it makes you laugh, it's useful. And you don't even have to tell me. I just want to, like, I know that someone out there is laughing, so that helps.
That's Samantha Irby you're listening to. Her life as a published writer started with her confessional blog, Bitches Gotta Eat, whose popularity propelled her to two book deals, the latest of which is with Vintage for her collection of essays titled We Are Never Meeting in Real Life. It's so funny, it causes readers to make weird snorting noises while reading it. I'm Clay Smith, I'm the editor of Kirkus Reviews, and I'm the one who snorts while reading Samantha's book. And this is Fully Booked, the podcast from Kirkus Reviews. Hey, Samantha.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So you're here in Austin with us today. You're going to be at Book People tonight?
Yes. It's 137 degrees today, which is perfect for a person like me who hates being outside and hot.
Right.
Definitely thinking of moving here.
So you're going to be in conversation tonight with Jenny Lawson, she's known as the bloggess.
The bloggess. Jenny and I have been internet friends mm-hmm. for a long time. Jenny's readership dwarfs mine. So I definitely was like, how do I get people to come see me in Texas? And Jenny agreed to talk to me, and I was like, oh, okay, that's how I get people right. to come see me in Texas.
Right.
So
right.
it should be fun. We both are a little awkward in person and like terrified to meet real people. So right. there will be a lot of sweating and stammering. I'm sure it's gonna be a good time.
Yeah. Well, moving from Jenny to more discussion of body fluids, I mentioned the snorting bit in that intro. You know, because this book is full of weird body fluids or noises. and it really, you cannot read this collection and not talk about that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I called your blog sort of confessional, and other critics have called your writing confessional. Does that seem right to you?
It does, although I don't tell everything.
Right.
Like, I don't tell, like, definitely I don't get into, like, my meanest, most terrible thoughts. So it's not outright confession.
Yeah.
Especially since I don't admit to any crimes. Like, that's what I think when I hear confessional. I mm-hmm. think, like, I don't, you know, I wasn't raised Catholic, so I don't think of, like, telling a priest my sins. I think of, like, you know, being like, I'm the one who killed her.
Right.
Confessional is probably, TMI.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because even as a critic, we don't have enough language or vocabulary mm-hmm. for, I mean, you have this, you know, really revealing and also very human chapter in this book about needing to stop on the side of the road to poop because you battle with Crohn's disease,
yeah.
right?
At the time, I didn't know. I just thought, like,
right.
You know, I just was like, I eat too much trash. But
right.
But now we later discovered that I had a
and
problem.
And one of your friends in the car was really comforting. The other kept changing radio stations just to mm-hmm. avoid the awkwardness.
I think, especially, you know, back then, before we told everyone all of our business on the internet, he definitely was of the, oh, what do you mean girls poop variety of human males. And so when I had to shatter, I don't know how I didn't shatter his illusions before. I mean, that dude probably watched me eat 600 Taco Bell tacos. But in that moment was really tough for him to have to see me sort of in all of my
right.
glory in a snowdrift on the side of yeah. I-88.
No, but it's nice that you mentioned that, you know, the internet has opened up this world where we do reveal all this mm-hmm. stuff about ourselves that we wouldn't have before. Has that, has the rise of the internet, I guess, made it easier for you to reveal these things, or?
Yeah, it's, I mean, I'm pretty open, and I have found the response to my openness has been good enough to keep me, like, still talking about it. But it's funny because people are still shocked. I mean, you know, everybody's a secret Puritan, I guess, because people are always like, how do you say that? And mm-hmm. I'm like, you mean talk about that very human function that you do all the time? I mean, I guess it's impolite. And so, like, I don't just walk around, like, walking into people's houses being like, man, I have to take a dump. But, you know, we should. That's the thing, is you could come in my house and say that because, like, I'm honest about it. But, mm-hmm. you know, there are still, like, pockets of people who are like, oh, don't talk like that. Or, right. oh, we don't say that. Those are naughty words. And, like, poop, at least, I feel like we should be talking about it a lot. Right. I think people carry, like, so much weird shame about it. I was in the airport yesterday on my way here, and I had a connecting flight, so I just like to sit in the bathroom and drain everything out before I have to get back on the plane.
Yeah.
And so I didn't have to poop, but I was sitting there for a long time, and it's so hilarious to me. And I just like scroll on my phone, like half the, if you get a text from me, guaranteed I was on the toilet when sending it. But like, it was so hilarious to me how women kept like scurrying in and out of the stall next to mine. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's because they're afraid they're going to hear some poop noise.
Right.
So they have to hurry up and like do their business and get out. And I just want to free us all from that. I don't know how it is with men. Like, I don't know if men just go and settle in and are like, all right, Jim, see you in 30 minutes. But yeah. like, I want us to get to that place as,
yeah.
as prudes and women and people mm-hmm. who have poop problems. I want yeah. us to be talking
I
about
think
it.
That's an accurate way to describe men in a public restroom. I mean, although this morning at our sort of workplace, which has many offices in it, there was a man going who was peeing, and he was still using his cell phone, which I thought was sort of odd.
Wait. Mm-hmm. See, that just makes me think, like, what a mess. Because, like, you should poop and pee and do whatever, but you should do it so that it's not, like, a trash can when
yeah.
you finish. How do you, I mean, now I'm like picturing how yeah. he was doing. I mean, the toilet after he left must have been revolting. And there's nothing worse than like sitting down in someone else's pee.
Yeah.
Because that's avoidable.
Well, he was using a urinal, so he has much more.
Oh, right. I'm picturing
surface
a stall.
Area.
Wait, so people could see. People could see that he wasn't keeping his pee in line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Welcome to the men's room. I saw it somewhere that you said that you started the blog to impress a dude who
yeah.
was kind of literary minded, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're actually married to your wife. Can we talk a little bit about the voyage from the former to the
latter? Absolutely. I believe I predicted in my first book, and probably in my blog before that I would end up with a woman. I have sort of, okay, so first I'm going to be serious and then I'm going to be stupid.
Okay.
So I have had, always had kind of like a fluid sexuality. Like, I'm into whoever's into me. Like,
right.
I take what I can get within reason, mm-hmm. and no matter the package, like, that's fine.
Right.
Just bring it. You want to be nice to me and do stuff for me and, like, rinse out my cereal bowl when I forget? Great. Okay, so now I'm going to be dumb and say that, of course, men are terrible. And I always knew that there was, like, an elementary school gym teacher in my future. Now my wife is a social worker, so I'm an elementary school social worker, so I missed the mark a little bit, but I mean, I knew that I was gonna eventually settle down with a sensibly shooed woman.
Right. who is Mavis in some of your essays.
Yeah. So I call it, her name is Kirsten, but I call her Mavis because in our initial getting to know you conversation, she asked me if I preferred Aretha Franklin or Mavis Staples. And I was like, Aretha, no shade to Mavis, right? She's amazing. But I was like, come on.
That's an easy one.
Yes. If for no other reason than the Blues Brothers, but like her storied career is amazing. And so she went to bat for Mavis Staples, and then making fun of her later, I called her Mavis.
And now you're married.
And now we're married. We fight about it every day.
You know, the thing that I admire about your essays is, you know, that people say that writing comedy is really hard. But I guess we could put your essays in this category of sort of seriocomic. You know, they're within one essay, you'll go from serious to funny, you know, often within
the same paragraph. I'm glad you explained that, because I was like, seriocomic, does he not know that I am dumb? Okay.
So can we just talk a little bit about how you do that? I mean, because that seems difficult to me, to go from serious to comic or vice versa.
I think that the easiest way for me to process something is to sort of mine the comedy from it. And like, with given enough time and perspective, I can find at least a humorous element in most things, especially like if they're embarrassing. Or, I mean, even the sad things, like I wrote about my dad and his sort of demise in this book.
He had a long battle with alcoholism.
Yeah, he was an alcoholic for a long time. And like, you know, he's been dead for almost 20 years. And my mom too. And like, with this much time, I can sort of state the facts seriously. But then when I'm analyzing them, I like gotta pull the funny out. Otherwise, like I'm gonna jump off a building. You know what I mean? If I can't find the funny parts in something, I cannot live. Because, yeah. I mean, life is miserable. So I'm always trying to like squeeze a little bit of humor out of whatever's happening.
Well, squeezing is perfect, because there's this one moment in an essay about your dad that for me just encapsulates all of your talents.
Yeah, I almost said it, but okay, tell it.
Pouring the shoe leather through a loaf of bread that your father did just to get whatever morsel of alcohol.
So at its root, right, you see a person drinking shoe polish and you're like, oh my god, that's horrifying. Right. And yeah, it's horrifying. And I have so much tenderness toward addicts, because we are weak, and like, I just don't believe in like, get it together, put the bottle down. Like, that's bananas to me, and not everyone can do it.
Right.
Okay. So like, I have so much empathy for people who are addicted to things. As a person who watched her dad drink shoe polish, the way I can continue to live a normal human life is to be like, can you believe this dude drank shoe polish? That's insane. It's also like the fact that he knew to strain the toxins through the bread. I'm like, my dad was a genius. He was like Bill Nye of getting drunk.
Perfect little detail. You remembered it.
Yeah.
Clearly. It is sad in a desperate kind of way.
Sure.
And yet it's gallows humor also.
Yeah.
It's a perfect moment.
Yeah. If he was sitting here right now doing it, I wouldn't be like, Dad, you're crazy. You're hilarious. That's so great. But like, now in hindsight, I'm like, oh, that poor dude. But also, that's hilarious.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's, if I didn't find it funny, like, I mean, like, what, you know, what would happen? Like, I often think about, like, the things I can laugh at in hindsight. I'm like, what would I be like if I couldn't? And that makes me real sad.
Yeah, yeah.
So I try to always, like, at least like pull a little bit of funny out, out of it. Also, I think too that it helps, you know, there's somebody who has a drunk dad at home who's like drinking NyQuil. I mean, that was my dad's, like, back when it used to have alcohol in it, that was his, like, his go-to, I'm not really drinking, but I'm drinking drink. And, like, there's somebody out there who can relate to that, who, I don't know, maybe they feel a little freer. Maybe they feel like, hey, it's not just happening to me. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, worth it for me to try to make jokes out of it, because maybe it'll help somebody else as much as it's helped me.
But you know, I mean, you're talking about sort of being an advocate in addition to being a writer, because not every writer is an advocate. And there's, I forget exactly which essay, but there's one of these essays where I think you might be talking about body shapes, and you know, there's actually a sentence where you encourage your reader to not put up with shit about, you know, any sort of guff from people who give them any problems.
Maybe you're thinking of the not being grateful for sex. I think that is, I mean, there's a lot of messages that we need to hear more, but one of them I don't feel like we hear at all is, like, you really don't have to, if your body is not the traditional, like, American bounce a quarter off it ideal, like, we, you know, there's sort of this unspoken thing that you gotta just be like, thank you for lifting my ham hocks in order to have sex with me. You know what I mean? And it's like, I know you're getting something too, and you like me, so I'm not gonna walk around like, you know, like Eeyore and like sad about my body and also grateful that, like, you know, a dude who works at Foot Locker has, like, is seeing it naked.
Right, you know,
he's getting something, I'm getting something. I don't need to be the one who's, like, you know, curtsying and, like, thanking him for his time.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah. But it also occurs to me that a writer who doesn't have, you know, a sizable audience probably isn't that invested to be in being an advocate.
I mean, right.
So when did you, how long in your career did it take until you started to see, oh, people will listen to my advice?
I think probably a couple, I don't have comments on my blog because I refuse to host a forum for people to tell me what a trash bag I am. Yeah. Trust me, I know. You think I'm ugly? I think I'm 10 times uglier than you think. You think I'm stupid? I know that I am stupider than you think. So I don't need anyone to, I don't need to, like, provide a place for you to tell me that. Like, the internet is vast. There are many places you can do it. So for a while, because there were no, like, comments to read, or, like, I didn't go seeking things out, I didn't know who I was reaching. And then people, you can email me through my blog if you can figure out how. And people would email me. And so I got my first email and was like, oh my God, people are just going to send me terrible things. And they have not. They might, but they have not yet. And so once or twice a week, I will get emails from people who are just like, thank you for talking about this. And, like, I don't feel like I'm really doing, I shouldn't say that. I feel like my writing is useful to people, and that's the most important thing. Right. Like, if it makes you laugh, it's useful. And you don't even have to tell me. I just want to, like, I know that someone out there is laughing, so that helps. But, like, when people would write to me and be like, thanks for talking about pooping all the time, or, like, how you can live in a fat body and, you know, not cry about it every day, or, like, whatever it is, then I was like, well, this is really reaching, like, people are reading this. Because really, what is the motivation to write a free blog, especially in 2017? Who, I mean, am I the last person with a blog? Me and the blog guest, the last two people writing things on the internet. I don't even have ads on mine, so it makes me no money. But I would get emails from people who are like, thank you for just being you and like sharing yourself and writing about it. So then I was like, well, I can like make this a platform. I kind of know who's reading, you know, you get 30 emails from like sad fat girls, you know who you're talking to, right? Mm-hmm. Not that they're my only audience, but they're my most beloved.
Right.
And so I'm like, well, I'm gonna write stuff to like, while entertaining people, but to make very specific people feel good. And so then I kind of started doing more things that are like, hey, I wrote a thing about, and I got so much fan mail. I wrote a blog about having stupid tattoos and like how everyone's like, my tattoo has meaning. And I'm like, mine is a cover up of this dude's initials that I got. And like so many people were like, thank you for talking about your horrible tattoos. So like, that's, I mean, it's really important to me to like keep my fan base at least a tiny bit uplifted. Mm-hmm. And so since I know who I'm talking to, I'm like, well, you know, here, I feel like weird saying that it's advice, because again, what do I know?
Right.
But I do have kind of like motivational things for people, like stop saying you're sorry and like just enjoy whatever's happening.
Yeah.
If you can. I mean, it's like joy is so fleeting. I just want people to like not be sad for 5 minutes, you know?
Yeah. That's an admirable goal. But I read in this interview in Chicago Magazine that, you know, people are always telling you that you're brave for revealing all these things about yourself. But you don't really see it that way. You see it more as it's freeing and liberating for you to get this out there.
It's, I think once I started to have people like regularly checking in for my writing, and I was performing in Chicago all the time, you can't really like lie about what you're like if people are going to see you, right? So like I could not pretend to be a svelte glamazon with nice teeth if people were gonna meet me and be like no. So then it was just like, okay, I'm going to be who I am because people are going to see it anyway. And then it's so much work to like pretend to be good. That's why I don't ever like, you know, people are like, why don't you talk about more like social issues? And I'm like, because I'm not that smart. Like, I am an expert in myself and like my sort of take on things. But I cannot be out here writing think pieces because I dropped out of college and I don't know a lot of big words. So it's just a lot more freeing to be like, this is what you get. Also, especially when I was dating and I was writing the blog and like dating all the time, you know, I don't have to tell you that I'm gonna poop in this diaper that I'm wearing. I mean, if I laugh too hard, because you read about it. And now if you've read about it, you can opt out beforehand. So then we never have to do this. Or, you know, if I'm like, I'm going to go to the bathroom and it's going to be like 7 real minutes before I come back,
right,
then you know what you're in for. And I don't have to feel like I've misled you.
Right. Right. So it is liberating.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. I mean, yeah, there have been, you know, there are things that I regret, you know, there have been things that have gone sour and I'm like, I shouldn't have put that online. Right. But for the most part, it's like, you know what you're getting. So here it is.
And so you mentioned, you know, being visible, and sort of in that context, your first essay collection, which is called Meaty, has been picked up for production at FX.
Yeah.
And you're an executive producer.
Yeah.
One of Amy Schumer's writers is working on it.
Yeah, Jesse Klein.
Yeah. And the Broad City.
Abby Jacobson,
ladies. Yeah. So update us, like, when can we expect it, and what has that all been like for you?
So, TV is slower than you could ever imagine.
Right.
Also, I feel like people think I'm, like, leading them on or whatever, but... So I actually have no idea when it's going to come out.
Okay.
But here's where we are. We did a draft, and they liked it, and we got notes.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're working on a second draft, which we're going to turn in the next couple of weeks.
Okay.
And then I think – so – and maybe this is just my experience, but I have been very grateful that no one puts the cart before the horse, right? Like, it's very, like, you do this, then we wait. You do this, then we wait. There's no, like, projected, like, this is going to happen then, and then you're going to do this. And so hopefully within the next couple of years, I don't – they. So I think the way it works is if they like – the finished pilot, then they'll let us shoot the pilot, which, good Lord, I hope they let us do, because there's a lot of diarrhea in it. That is my goal, right? Is to get, I mean, this is such a poop-centric conversation. I'm sorry. But this is like a smart podcast. Like, Kirkus is like, and all I'm doing is talking about taking a dump. But
you don't have to punch.
I would like to get a main character with IBD on your TV once a week. Like, that is my dream. And if they let us make this show, that is what you're going to get. Like, diarrhea is the co-star.
With someone who's playing you.
Right. It will not be the real me.
So... when this actress comes in to audition,
I will die. I will be a corpse. I cannot. I'm already imagining, like, people studying. People are listening to my voice, right? So I have this weird Midwestern kind of Valley Girl nasal thing happening. I can't stand to listen to my own voice. I make a lot of, like, motions with my hands that are, like, squeezing an invisible butt, like, when I talk. So I'm like, oh, my God, if they watch anything where I've been recorded doing the invisible butt squeeze while talking this weird Midwestern surfer talk, I'm going to die. I can't be in the room. I will never watch the show. I mean, I guess I have to, right? To, like, make sure it looks how I want to, but I will be, like, head under a blanket the whole time. I have to think of this person as not me in order to get through it. All the stuff we've been writing and working on, like, it's Sam in the third person. I'm just like, and then Sam says, or what if Sam does? Because if I think of it as me, I'm like, no, I can't. Oh, God. But I want to do it. And I think we could, like, we're going to make a really cool thing that's going to be really great. But also, it'll be the death of me to listen to people try to talk like me.
I'm just
going to be like, just be you. Just do it like you. Say it the way you would say it. Don't try to sound like me.
And then try to sound a little bit like me.
Oh, could you imagine, though, listening to somebody imitate or watching them imitate you? Oh,
yeah.
It's acting.
That sounds painful.
Oh, my God. I'm having a heart attack right now. And this is in some future universe, right? Oh, my God. It's worth it.
Yeah.
But it's going to be weird.
It's going to be rough. So how is writing for TV different than writing an essay?
Well, so I'm learning a lot. One of the things, like, I don't write a lot of dialogue, right? In fiction, you write how people talk to each other. So in one of my first passes at writing a scene, I sent it to Jesse, and I was, like, real proud of it, right? I'm like, this is so funny. I am a genius. And then Jesse sent it back and was like, so, dude, here's the thing. In our minds, everyone we know, because our friends are great, we're great, everyone we know is funny and just shooting zingers all the time and is great. And she's like, that's not how it is in real life. Mm-hmm. And she's like, so when you write these scenes where everyone is funny, everyone just ends up sounding like you. And you have to like create different voices. And you have to like from sentence, she's like, when you write for television, from sentence to, so we only have what, 22 minutes to mm-hmm. work with. Every sentence has to like move a scene forward or shift the dynamic in some way. It can't just be like two people like riffing about how fun they are. Mm-hmm. Like you have to move scenes along. So I think the biggest difference is that I am the ruler of the universe in my essays, right? Mm-hmm. It's all from my perch on high. You know, everything I think is great, everything I think is funny gets included. And then, you know, an editor will like whittle it down and be like, listen, you really veered off course here or whatever. But even then, I'm the one who gets to fix it. With TV, it's like, other people get a vote immediately. Mm-hmm. Other people tell me that that's not how how people talk.
Right.
I'm like, in my world, though, they would be really funny. And also, like, I don't have to do a lot of, like, creating a scene. Like, I can tell you I was in this room and this is what it looked like and this is what it felt like. But when you're writing for TV, you have to think, like, tell me specifically what the room looked like. Where are people? Where are things placed? Mm-hmm. And like, where's the camera going to be? Who should the camera be on? It is the most challenging thing I've ever done. Granted, I don't do a lot of challenging things because that's not the way I like my life set up. Right. My childhood was hard. I like to do things that are easy for me.
Yeah.
So the learning the TV stuff is real hard.
Yeah.
But it's cool hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's cool hard.
Yeah. Well, I hope this felt easy to you.
Yeah, this was great.
This was a lot of fun.
Good.
Thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck tonight.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Hope you saw a lot of books.
Thank you.
That was Samantha Irby, and now we're joined by Megan LaBrice, star reporter for Kirkus Reviews and co-host of this podcast. Hey, Megan.
Hey, Clay.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you for asking. I'm even better because my spirits are so uplifted by that delightful interview.
Gosh, did I write that script for you to say?
No. Mm. But believe you me, I really, truly enjoyed every minute of it. And from the outset, I don't know what she's talking about her voice, because I think I fell a little bit in love with it during the course of the interview.
Yeah, she's pretty great.
She's so great.
It definitely has a unique voice on the page in addition to in person.
I mean, I love everything she has to say about poop. That's great. But my very favorite thing that she said was about writing for TV and mm-hmm. how every sentence needs to move it forward or shift the dynamic in some way. And you need to move scenes along. I love that. And frankly, I think some books could use a little more of that.
Yeah, you love it until you have to do it. It's pretty hard, I think.
Harkening back to things you love until you have to do them, have you ever moved cross-country?
I have, and please never again.
Yeah, not so much the fresh start it's promised as. But apparently still 40 million Americans move every year.
Oh, God.
Right?
Don't they have anything better to do?
No. So in the long haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road, Finn Murphy invites readers to clamber up into the glossy cab of a custom tractor trailer and hit the open highway. Murphy is a professional long-haul mover, known among truckers as a bedbugger, and he specializes in cross-country relocations of executive-class clients. Now, he's a debut memoirist. Hi, Finn. Thanks for joining us today on Fully Booked.
Hello, Megan. Great to be here.
This is, I'm a lucky girl because this is actually our second time talking in as many days. For our listeners, Finn and I were in conversation in front of a lively crowd last night at Powell City of Books here in Portland, Oregon. How was that experience for you?
Wasn't that fun? That really was.
Yeah, they were great.
It was conversational rather than, you know, just giving a reading and sort of moving along.
So, I mean, now that you're well into this book tour, what's harder, writing a book and going on a tour, or loading 35 tons of irregularly shaped, fragile and precious and heavy things into perfect tiers in the back of a 50-foot three trailer and taking it from Greenwich, Connecticut to Aspen, Colorado?
Book tour definitely has its challenges. the thing about doing all those things that you just enumerated there is that I'm used to it.
Yeah.
So it's just, you know, it's a regular working day. The book tour things, it's a lot of fun though, actually. I mean, I always, you know, I've been trying to write this book for like 40 years. So, and I always had this thing in my mind, oh my God, wouldn't it be great if somebody wanted to, you know, go to an event and do that. I mean, I've been to a million author events. So being in the center of one is a blast.
And actually, this book tour ends up almost perfectly coinciding with the 37th anniversary of your CDL license.
That's right. You pointed that out last night. That's a little frightening when I think about it.
So you mentioned...
It was a couple of days after my 21st birthday, and that was back when you could get, you know, you could get a commercial driver's license back then, but you could almost phone it in. I took a tractor trailer, I went around two orange cones, and the examiner said, all right, good, get out of here, and he gave me my commercial driver's license. And now you have to spend a month at a truck driving school and spend like $8,000.
Man, oh man, build me a time machine. So you mentioned that you've been thinking about this book pretty much as long as you've been a driver. What made you want to guide readers through this world?
It's one of those questions that I always get asked. It's like if you go to a cocktail party and you're a doctor, somebody's always talking to you about their prostate. So when I go to when I go out and I tell people that I'm a long-haul truck driver, I mean, the questions just start piling on, and everybody wants to know things. And then when they find out that I'm not only a driver, but that I'm a mover and I move people, then they get even more interested because, you know, 40 million Americans move every year, Megan. So it's a universal experience of which many people are dissatisfied with. So they all want to know, how do I move next time? What should I move, and what are the pitfalls I can avoid?
It's interesting. So you're a mover, aka a bed bugger, and your tractor trailer is known affectionately, I'm sure, as a roach coach. And all of this slang, this vocabulary is such an important part of the trucking world. And it's such an enjoyable part of reading the book, like learning the definitions of all of these things. But there's one vocabulary word in particular I'd like you to define for our listeners so we can move forward with this interview. And it is a four-wheeler. What is that?
A four-wheeler. Well, you're a four-wheeler driver, Megan. Four-wheelers are cars. And so that's, and we're 18-wheelers, we call ourselves sometimes. We call ourselves big trucks, and we're different than you guys.
So on the subject of four-wheelers, to a four-wheeler, that is a casual observer, it might seem like all big trucks do the same job. And you write in the book that that is not so. So I was wondering if you could share, who are the different types of truckers and what is the hierarchy of the road?
Yes. Yeah, so of course, the hierarchy depends on what seat you're sitting in. So we're the bed buggers. We're called bed buggers because we move people's stuff. And then we have hazardous material haulers, and those are called suicide jockeys. Then you have skateboarders. Those are people that drive flatbeds. Then you have live animal haulers. And when I say live animal hauler here, I don't mean, you know, a parakeet in the sleeper or something. I mean, you know, a big trailer, a big trailer filled with cattle or chickens or goats or something like that. We call them chicken chokers.
Oh.
And nobody actually, I think it's pretty unanimous about who's at the bottom of the pile here in this hierarchy. Yeah, it's the chicken chokers. Nobody wants to be near them. So you can always find them at the truck stops because they're out there all by themselves because these trucks, they really smell. So on a summer night, You know, I might pull into the truck stop and go to sleep in my sleeper, and there won't be anybody around me. And then I'll wake up at 3 a.m. and just with this horrible smell, and I don't know what's going on. And I'll look out into my mirror, and there'll be a chicken choker on either side of me, and then I have to move.
Oh man, that's pretty brutal. You might want to stick to the northern routes then. You know, in the hotter weather, I'm sure that adds to the olfactory burden.
Yeah, well, nothing seems to help. I mean, I don't know how often these trucks get cleaned up. Probably get cleaned up after every load, but it doesn't take long. You know, if you got 75 cows standing in a trailer.
So you've got chicken chokers, you got bed buggers, you got skateboarders. But one thing all truckers have in common, surely, is that you're all watching us, the four-wheelers, from up high above, aren't you? You're looking right down into our cars every day.
We see everything. Everybody remember that. We see everything. There's this weird thing about people driving four-wheelers is that they think they're anonymous. So, I mean, how anonymous can you be? You've got a license plate, which shows you exactly who you are and where you are. And then from us, because we're way up high, we can see all of the behaviors that people engage in. So it's kind of like being in the middle of Times Square. But people don't behave that way. They behave as if they're home in their bedrooms. And that makes for an interesting day sometimes.
I can only imagine. Well, I don't need to imagine because I'm sure I've perpetrated my fair share of road offenses.
Here's the thing about driving. If you're driving, then the thing to do is just be driving and not engage in some other behavior. So here's the sort of the most popular behaviors that people indulge in an automobile is eating, drinking, coffee, Coca-Cola, so forth. Some people drink beer in the car, spilling those drinks. Disciplining the kids in the back seat is a very common activity. Putting on makeup, texting. But the most common activity I see in a car or in a four-wheeler is the driver is working on their personal relationship with the person in the passenger seat.
Oh,
and you can tell from the body language. Yes, everybody's arguing or working things out.
A million dramas every day.
Exactly. It's too bad I can see them, but I can't hear them. It's probably just as well.
So you're not just driving on the road. There are many other parts to your job, notably going into the ones you're writing about in this book are typically palatial homes and making sure everything is packed just so, loaded just so, makes it across safely, and then, you know, it's all done in reverse on the other side. What about your work do you find most fulfilling about helping these families move?
You know, the work looks like brute force, I suppose, from the outside. But in order to move people effectively and without destroying everything that they own, it takes a lot of specialized knowledge. And there's specialized things in homes like pianos, there's artwork, there's sculptures. So I have to be able to know how to do all this, and I have to have crews arranged around the country who know how to do all this. And then we have the actual manual labor part, which in a regular day, you know, is probably 10, 12, 14 hours to get the trailer loaded. If you combine that brute force machismo, so to speak, and specialized knowledge, and the camaraderie of working with a crew of people that you've worked with before, it's actually, I think it's choice worthy work, and I find it very satisfying, and I get to help these families navigate this transition into a new life.
You're an avid audiobook listener. You admit to a sizable audible.com habit, the truck, and having a wee bit of a crush on NPR's Terry Gross. So you're a book lover. Do you think one day soon you'll be cruising down the interstate and a convoy of trucks will come around and they might be listening to your book? Do you think that other truckers will get a kick out of this? Or did you mostly intend it for the layman?
I would love it if my fellow drivers would listen to this book. And I think that I think it will resonate with them. There hasn't been, you know, there's not a lot of books out there, especially reasonably, I hope it's a reasonably intelligent, reasonably literate book about the experience of it out there. So that's one thing. And I do listen to a lot of audio books. I have an audio book habit that needs a 12-step program.
Well, I would agree on the finer points of the book. Intelligent, a rip-roaring good time. In fact, it's a hell of a ride, I'd say. And we all enjoyed it very much.
A hell of a ride. Well, that's what I wanted to give. It's got some serious parts. Mostly it's breezy, chatty, and fun.
Well, this has been a lot of fun for me. I think that we're all out of time for today, but I'm so glad you were able to join us on Fully Booked, Finn. Thanks again.
Thanks very much, Megan. You take care.
I think we learned from that interview that those of us in four-wheelers ought to behave in the car, right?
I'll certainly think twice before disciplining the kids.
Your non-existent children. That'll be so tough for you. That's like giving up spinach for Lent when you don't even like spinach.
Yeah, as a former Catholic, I totally identify with that. You've got me pegged. Oh, but it was a lot of fun to learn about that world. I was always curious, I've got to admit.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
The ultimate insider scoop on the latest books, right here on Fully Booked.
Here I'm walking through a field and I'm thinking about a girl just a few years younger than me that was stabbed to death.
There are 120,000 unsolved murder cases in America, and each one is called a cold case.
She said, "I think my dad could be responsible. I think he killed them."
These are some of those rare cases.
Cold Case Files, the podcast. Don't miss a moment. Subscribe now on the Podcast One app, Apple Podcasts, or at PodcastOne.com. And don't forget to watch or DVR Cold Case Files, the TV show, every Thursday at 10 on A&E. This is Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Thanks for joining us.
Before we get our editors on the podcast to tell us which bestsellers this week are worth your time, we want to tell you a little bit about a better way to get the car you want. There's something about TrueCar a lot of people don't know, which is that using TrueCar can also help you buy a used car. In fact, there are over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. Whether you're looking to buy new or used, you can get upfront pricing information that empowers, discounts off the list price for used cars, and a better buying experience through our TrueCar certified dealer network. There are over 700,000 pre-owned vehicles available from TrueCar certified dealers nationwide. You'll see what other people paid for the car you want so you can know what a fair price is and feel confident. With TrueCar, you can connect with a local certified dealer of your choosing so you can enjoy a quick, easy buying experience. Using TrueCar, you can easily find the new or used car you want. Over 3 million cars have been sold to TrueCar users by the TrueCar Certified Dealer Network. There are over 13,000 TrueCar Certified Dealers nationwide. When you're ready to buy a new or used car, visit TrueCar to enjoy a more confident car buying experience. Some features not available in all states. Each week, we bring our seasoned senior editors onto the podcast to tell us, out of all of the bestsellers that are out this week, which you ought to race out and buy and which you might want to skip. So Vicki Smith is our children's and teen editor. What do you have for us this week, Vicki?
I am so incredibly excited to see that When Dimple Met Rishi by Sandhya Menon has made the bestseller list. It's a book that I fell in love with when I read it last spring in Galley, and I've been talking about it to everybody I know if they want a fresh, fun romance. It's about Dimple Shah, who is a first-generation Indian American, and she is a coder. And she's spending the last summer before college at what's called InsomniaCon, which is a super competitive app development conference. And one of the things, Dimple loves her parents more than anything, but she does not love the fact that her parents want her to marry the ideal Indian husband. So when Rishi Patel shows up at InsomniaCon with his great-grandmother's ring and gets down on his knees to propose to her at their first meeting, she is horrified. So what seems to be starting out very badly, as far as a romance is concerned, is fresh and funny and does some pretty unexpected things for both the characters and the readers. I cannot love this book more or recommend it more highly.
Awesome. And if we insisted that you tell us the name of a bestseller that we might want to avoid this week, and we are making you do that, which would it be?
Well, it's another romance. It is a new Melissa Cruz book called Alex and Eliza, A Love Story. And it is piggybacking on the phenomenal success of the Hamilton musical. So there's a fair amount of interpolated, imagined dialogue in an attempt to make this 18th century romance as swoony as possible. And it's not terrible, but it's not great. So if you have time for just one romance this summer, absolutely make it When Dimple Met Rishi.
Awesome. Thank you.
Moving on to the wonderful world of nonfiction. Hey, Eric, how are you today?
Hey, Megan, doing well.
Glad to hear it. What's your number one choice for our listeners this week in nonfiction?
This is a tough one because there's a lot of good ones on the bestseller list this week, but I'm going to go with Mark Bowden's new book called Hue 1968, A Turning Point of the American War in Vietnam. And though the war was before my time, it's always been one of the most fascinating topics in 20th century history for me. And this tells the story of the 1968 battle that really turned the tide and basically turned it into an American defeat. And as usual in Bowden's book, you know, he's the author of Black Hawk Down, among other bestsellers. And he does a great job of kind of piling these set pieces atop on top of each other. The action is amazing. He kind of builds portraits really well of the combatants on both sides. And our reviewer called it an anecdotally rich, careful account of the complex campaign to take the city. He also called it one of the best books on a single action in Vietnam. So I think this is, and I've read plenty of books on Vietnam as well, and this is certainly in my top three. So wow. Highly recommended.
Okay.
Now, and it's about 700 pages, but it flies by.
You know, I'm often skeptical when I hear that.
Yes.
But you're a solid authority, so I'm going to trust you.
And I'm not one for long books, so you can trust me here.
Thanks. Now, I understand that you had a bit of a difficulty coming up with what not to buy this week.
I did. The bestseller list is pretty solid, like I mentioned before. So I'm going to just go with what's number one, and that's Kevin Hart's book, The Comedian. It just debuted at number one. We actually gave it kind of a middling review. We called him an entertaining guide to a life in comedy. But we also said that it's about 50 pages too long, and it's filled with too many platitudes. So if you're a fan, you're going to enjoy it. And I know he has plenty of fans. But for anyone else, you can skip.
Good to know. Thanks, Eric.
All right, thanks.
And our fiction editor, Laurie Muchnick, is on vacation this week. So let me tell you about who we're going to interview next week. You might remember a novel from Nina George titled The Little Paris Bookshop. It was a big bestseller a few years ago. And so her new one is called The Little French Bistro. And she'll be in the studio next week. So we encourage you to join us then. And now you know what time it is. It's time to turn this thing off and go read a book.
Thanks for listening to Fully Booked by Kirkus Reviews. Check out new episodes every Tuesday at podcastone.com, on the Podcast One app, or you can subscribe on iTunes.
Hi guys, it's Becca Tobin,
Kelsey Knight,
and Jack Zanuck.
And we are the Lady Gang, as in the Lady Gang podcast. And this summer we have something extra special, not just celebrity interviews, but we are helping you Lady Gang your life / get your together. What do we have coming up, Kelsey?
Hormone expert, nutrition expert,
fitness expert,
sex expert,
dermatologist, people shooting up your faces with syringes telling us what it's all about.
It's all the important things you need to Lady Gang your life.
Every Tuesday on Podcast One and Apple Podcasts.